Bar Agricultural District Committee, Frank K. Friedman, Joseph W. Miles III, William M. Stanley, Appellant Counsel, Mark R. Herring, Attorney General, Matthew R. McGuire, Principal Deputy Solicitor General, Kendall T. Cowell, Deputy Attorney General, Carolyn R. Dorofsky, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Sandra S. Rager, Assistant Attorney General, and Police Counsel.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Frank Friedman, representing Joseph Morrissey. Senator William Stanley is with me at counsel's table. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Did you say two?
Two, yes, sir. We challenge the three-judge panel's decision that Mr. Morrissey violated three disciplinary rules and that these infractions warranted revocation of his license to practice law. In the course of the five-day hearing, 18 additional claims brought by the bar were either stricken by the tribunal or withdrawn by the bar. Of the three violations, two dealt with Mr. Morrissey's firm's representation of David Jones, a client who was charged with felony malicious wounding and some other serious charges, and the firm actually got those charges null prost. The third violation arose out of Morrissey's Alford plea and conviction for a Class 1 misdemeanor contributing to the delinquency of a minor. And the minor is now his wife and the mother of their three children.
How long have they been married?
I'm sorry?
How long have they been married?
I believe 3-4 years.
Okay.
Before we address the individual violations, the parties do have some significant procedural disputes, which I'd like to outline very briefly. We think that paragraph 13 of part 6, section 4, requires the panel to issue findings of fact and to identify the nature of the misconduct found by such findings of fact. And the court here didn't do this. And the bar's brief at pages 11 and 12 argues the three-judge panel is not subject to paragraph 13. We think that's plainly contrary to Virginia Code section 54.1, 39 and 35, and 3915. So we think paragraph 13 applied to this proceeding.
If you're right, would it simply be a matter of remanding so they can do that task? I know the brief says new trial. That doesn't make sense. I'm not following that.
It's an interesting situation because
let me give you a couple of analogies. In habeas, the trial judge is required to make factual findings, and we've sent at least one case back where the court didn't do that. But we don't say, "Oh, you need to start afresh." In admin hearings, Court of Appeals has done the same thing. In divorce hearings, the same thing. So I'm not sure why you. I know why tactically why you want it, but why would we do that?
Well, it's a complicated problem, and it kind of depends on what my colleagues on the other side have to say. In Livingston and Pappas, this court reviewed disciplinary violations to determine whether the factual findings supported the conclusions by clear and convincing evidence that violations were established. Now, there aren't factual findings here, but And they're arguing, oh, we didn't have to do it. Well, they did have to do it. Towards the back of their brief, they start to say, well, there were stipulations. They listed those. So those are the factual findings. Well, if those are the factual findings, they're deficient. So if they go there, we think on two of them, they're totally deficient.
How are they deficient if those are the factual findings?
Well, if they're the factual findings, going back to Pappas and Livingston, they do not prove first, it sort of begs the question, why have a five-day trial if your entire factual findings are going to be stipulations of fact? But second, they then list all of the people who testified, but they don't say what they found about them. But if we skip straight to what those stipulations say, I know you all have read the briefs, and I know it's complicated, So there's a miscommunication as to the supervision. There's no evidence Mr. Morrissey knows that she hasn't taken the oath yet. He's been a diligent boss, and she comes in twice and says, finally it's official, you know, I'm a real lawyer. And he testifies. He thought that, you know, finally, the second celebration. There's no evidence to the contrary. So there is a miscommunication, but as to supervision, it's not vicarious liability. She appeared, so he's liable, is their argument. But that's vicarious liability.
I'm not sure I got an answer to my question about if you're right about the failure to make factual findings, why not remand to the three-judge panel to say, do that, as opposed to, as I read your brief,
sure,
have a whole new trial?
Well, that's and that's the fault of my answer perhaps being too long-winded, but the answer is, I think it probably goes back if they concede there are no findings. But if they say, no, we still win, though there are findings, they're truncated, but there are, under Pappas and Livingston, they are defective, and here's why. There's no finding as to supervision. You know, it's not vicarious liability. It's a duty of supervision independent from the act. The evidence is, Ms. Battle.
May I ask you again, Mr. Friedman, exactly what language in paragraph 13 requires the three-judge circuit court to issue specified findings of fact? What exact language requires that?
Okay, we start with 3935, which says that we follow paragraph 13. Paragraph 13, then I believe it's 1318, says there shall be a memorandum opinion. 13.1 defines memorandum opinion and says it shall have findings of fact and tie it to the nature of the misconduct.
And your reading is that specifically applies to the three-judge court as opposed to simply the disciplinary board?
Under 3935, yes. They shall follow the same rules. And 3915 says just because you go to a court panel, you know, you still follow the rules. So yes, that's our position.
The statute says just follow the rules generally, and you go to a rule, but the rule seems to be geared towards the disciplinary board, not to the three-judge. And there are rules specific to the three-judge.
What I think happened, I mean, Kuczynski is a different case. It was an appeal case, and they didn't have to follow it there. But here, it's, as we read it and as we think it's intended, you don't lose the protection. It's not like you have the right to go to a three-judge panel, but you lose all your protections. We think it's the same. It's what 3935 says, which is the rules and procedures set forth in Part 6, Section 4, Paragraph 13 of the Rules of the Supreme Court of Virginia shall govern any attorney disciplinary proceeding before a three-judge circuit court. 13-1.
Okay,
thank you. It is an important question. So, Justice McCullough, getting back to, you know,
I don't want to use up all your time.
Well, no, it's. I mean, supervision, they don't have any evidence. They didn't put any on, and there's no finding. There's no finding that there was no supervision, except that he sent her, but he didn't know, and it's uncontested.
But would part of supervising be when I know I have a brand-new law school graduate, and at some point is going to be formally licensed and have the oath of office? Isn't it incumbent upon me as a supervisor to know when that moment has happened before I send her off to court unassisted to act as a lawyer?
It had been about 5 months, and she had said, you know, I think
there's a passage of time that...
The question is there a finding? And there is.
No, that I understand.
Yeah,
I understand your point there.
So we win. There's no, under Pappas and Livingston, the court reviewed the disciplinary violations. Do the factual findings support the conclusion by clear and convincing evidence?
They don't.
So then let's look briefly at the contributing to the delinquency. By the way, same with assisting. I mean, it's not like he said, hey, whatever you do, don't tell the judge you haven't taken the bar yet, or try and walk in and act like you have taken the bar. There's no participation. And we cite cases that say, you know, he just didn't know. It's a single miscommunication. And I might add, there's not a case out there from any jurisdiction that we've seen that holds this out as a violation that would lead to a revocation.
Well, shouldn't he have known? Isn't that what the duty of the supervisor is? You just don't hire young people in your office and go, I'm not even going to look into whether or not you can actually practice law yet.
I would say that she has, and frankly, every associate I've talked to would say the same. If somebody asks you to go appear, you have to eventually say, hey, you know, I haven't taken the oath yet. I'm not throwing her under the bus. I'm saying everyone, you know, your clerks would probably tell you the same. I mean, it is clear on the face of the document. Page 130, page 133, it says you can't do this until you've taken the oath. She said she didn't read that or she didn't remember reading it. And she said she didn't think it applied to her. JA 3116.
That's why she needs some supervision. That's well, what mentor lawyers are supposed to do.
Again, no finding. No finding at all.
Well, isn't the finding that it never happened and he didn't look into it and he didn't seem to have any interest in looking into it?
Well, I think that's not the finding, because the finding is that there was a big show that she had finally passed and that it was official. And I'm going to move to the contributing to the delinquency of a minor, because again, that claim under 18.2371 is based on his relationship with Myrna Pride, now his wife. And Mr. Morsey was convicted of this misdemeanor after entering an Alford plea. 8.4B says it's professional misconduct for a lawyer to commit a criminal or deliberate act that reflects adversely on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness. Now, crime is defined by paragraph 13, which is another reason it really matters whether or not paragraph 13 applies to this hearing. Under paragraph 13, a crime is a felony or essentially crimes of moral turpitude. In Tasker, this court determined that contributing to the delinquency of a minor does not, as a matter of law, involve moral turpitude. And the court seemed to feel the same way at JA 2966 and on 669 to 71. There's no indication on the face of it that this was anything but a straight contributing to the delinquency of a minor, no moral turpitude. So, again, there are no findings of fact, and that does play havoc with the Rule 8.4b analysis. We don't know which prong or fitness factor the court relied on. There's no identification or discussion of the criminal act or a nexus to unfitness, which Barrett says is very important. And the stipulations don't help. They don't state a basis for a deliberate wrongful act either, or a criminal act. But they do say, at JA 2039, the one factual statement they make is that Carter Nichols testified that Morrissey believed Myrna was an adult. Now, the bar argues it was a deliberately wrongful act to receive text messages and pass on pornographic pictures of a minor, but if those stipulations are taken as true, I'm not saying, you know, then he thought she was a minor. He did not think she was a minor. And that's what the clear evidence is. They have a few stray pieces of evidence that he maybe should have, but the vast majority of people said he didn't. So that takes him straight out of the deliberately wrongful.
So your position is because he said he didn't know it was not?
No.
What
our position is, see, that's what makes this so hard, and I'm glad you asked. Deliberately wrongful means, you know, different from criminal. It's criminal, it's just not a crime. There are two prongs. Is it a criminal or deliberately wrongful act? It's deliberately wrongful if he knows that he's doing this with the
and
minor.
And wasn't the three-judge panel, based on the evidence before it, couldn't they find that he did know?
But
there
if
was
the
evidence in the record that he did
if
know.
The but they didn't make that finding, and the stipulation says he thought she was not a minor. I will reserve the remaining time, but we don't think under Livingston or Pappas that they did make findings of fact that proved these violations. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Matt McGuire on behalf of the Virginia State Bar. This is a straightforward appeal of a bar disciplinary decision. It's not a criminal case. The point of bar disciplinary proceedings is to protect the public and to demonstrate that the bar and the judiciary will maintain the ethics of the legal profession, lest the public's confidence in it diminish. Licensure is a privilege, not a right. There were three violations that the three-judge panel found
issues. Let's tackle the written findings of fact piece. The code provision says that Part 6, Section 4, Paragraph 13 applies when you have a three-judge disciplinary proceeding.
That's correct, Justice
McCall. And then the way I think you can read it is you just swap out board for three-judge panel, and then the rules apply. So, in your brief, you said, no, it's just different. So, walk me through that. Why would it be different in terms of making factual findings that as to exactly what they concluded, as opposed to simply saying, here's the stipulations of fact?
Your Honor, sure. If I could start with the background principle in the Commonwealth, which is that circuit courts and trial courts in Virginia do not have to make factual findings. This court in Fitzgerald had said that you need a clear statement from the legislature to that effect.
Right.
And so you have the code section here which says you apply Part 6 of this court's rules to three-judge courts. Those rules are extensive.
Okay.
And it is a very small subsection of those rules that could even apply to three-judge courts. So in some sense, it's burying the lead to trial courts that they need to make detailed factual findings. And
but the bar is basically an administrative agency. And here you're swapping out a board composed of lawyers with three judges. And so they are judges, but they're functioning in the disciplinary capacity,
well,
right?
And that's for the person who's being charged with a disciplinary infraction to make the choice. So 3915 does say, and I understand this court's precedent to say, if you elect to have three judges, you get them.
Right.
But then you have to figure out how that applies. And we think the court's Part 5 of the court's rules as it relates to appeals does distinguish between the three-judge panel and what they need to find, which is your notice of appeal runs 30 days from the final judgment, versus if you're dealing with a disciplinary board in which it's 30 days from the memorandum opinion. So we don't think there are factual findings required at all in this context, just because the background norms that apply would indicate the trial courts and trial court judges
to ignore
them. Make them.
Plain language of so the code says the whole thing applies. So applying just a straight up plain language analysis, if you follow, I mean, you have to piece it together, but the board has to do an opinion and a memorandum opinion that includes factual findings. We just heard earlier in the week a three-judge disciplinary proceeding where the three-judge panel did make those factual findings. Maybe they were overachievers. You know, they went beyond. But just applying strictly a garden variety plain language, it seemed unclear to me how we hurdle what the... And that doesn't mean you lose. It just means I have to do the factual findings.
Well, Justice McCullough, a couple of points. First, trial courts can't always make factual findings, and if they do, they're entitled to deference. So here, my position is, yes, the plain language says that all of those provisions from Part 6 apply, but they don't. If the court looks at the actual set of rules, they can't apply. For the most part, the rules don't talk about anything even related to what a three-judge court would be engaged in doing. So it can't be a true plain language approach because most of those rules are irrelevant. So what the court is saying is the legislature has instructed three-judge courts...
Well, but it has to mean something because they are adjudicating the case the same as... So I agree with you that there's all this stuff about, you know, the clerk of the disciplinary system. Well, they're not that, so that wouldn't apply to them.
Justice... to step back for one second, assume that I'm wrong, that they do have to make factual findings, or there's an argument that they do. I have two other arguments on it. One being that they did actually make factual findings here. There's a recitation of stipulated facts, as well as the court saying, we considered all of the evidence, and here is our conclusion. In addition, this court's standard of review sort of presupposes that the factual findings aren't the complete ball game here. The court says we will give deference sort of to factual findings made by the three-judge panel. But the standard review also says that this court engages in a review of the entire record to decide whether or not it is reasonable for the three-judge panel to have reached its conclusion. And so if the court is going to look to the entire record anyway, then it's not clear how the factual findings are really binding this court on notice.
Right, but we would have to do that anyway where there may be a challenge to the applicability of a particular disciplinary rule or to a finding itself.
Well, I think our position, Your Honor, would be under this for the right result wrong reason doctrine that this court applies in criminal cases as well as others. As the appellee, we can defend on any ground in the record ordinarily. And if the court is going to look to the entire record to decide if something is unreasonable, I can see how the factual findings would be helpful from an administrative agency perspective, but I don't see the substantive right violation.
I can think of three contexts where we've just sent things back. Habeas, where the statute, not an incorporation by reference, says make factual findings, and we've sent cases back to circuit court when they didn't do that. Court of Appeals has administrative law decisions, which seems analogous, where the administrative body didn't make the factual findings. They sent it back. And then in divorce cases where I believe Justice Kelsey wrote an opinion then for the Court of Appeals saying, code says you have to make findings, you didn't, it goes back. So,
well, Justice McCullough, in all those cases, I actually believe the code says make findings, and that is not what the code says here. The code is far less clear.
You have an incorporation by reference.
Sure, Your Honor, but an incorporation by reference of a huge panoply of things that just don't apply. So it's just not clear.
But the ones that do apply should be applied, shouldn't they, counsel? If the memorandum of opinion applies to both the board and the court, then shouldn't there be findings of facts and conclusions of law?
Your Honor, I would agree that it would be a better case if we had a more fulsome set of findings of fact. Again, our position, which I'll shift to, is that there are findings of fact. In this case, the court recites the factual stipulations that apply to each of these three charges, and I'll just walk the court through them. With the background sort of standard review point, which is we are the appellee here, we prevailed below, so the facts have to be viewed in the light most favorable to the bar and to the fact that
the only one I had any trouble with is the assist part. So I understand the supervision thing. You have a young lawyer. You're not sure they're licensed. You need to make sure they're licensed before you dispatch them off to court. Then he pleads, it's Alfred plea, but to a crime. I get that. The assist part, what was the assisting that he did?
Sure, Justice McCullough. Here I would say it was more than assist. It was directory because it was a direction from a newly barred associate. Let's put a little context on this claim. She was hired before she had even passed the bar. This is a brand new lawyer who is being directed in a small
law firm. I kind of argument that the rules say assist, and if you direct, that's even worse than assist.
Yes, Justice McCullough, that's my point, and she was directed to go.
And on those two sort of things, isn't it really the same factual basis for each charge?
Yes, Justice McCullough. The basic factual predicate here is that you hired a newly barred attorney. She had gone along the way towards becoming fully admitted to be a lawyer practicing in Virginia. She hadn't stood in this court to take the oath that's required by the statute, and she was directed by her supervising attorney to go to court. So it forms the predicate for both charges. I understand my friend to be making a multiple punishments type of an argument, but there's only one punishment here. It's a revocation punishment. And so you have a variety of violations that lead to one punishment. It's not as if he was brought before the bar for the 5.1 violation, gets a public reprimand, and then they bring him back under 5.5 and say, okay.
Or they issue one punishment for this charge, you have to do this, that, the other, and then for this other charge, then we're going to punish you this different way, and you have to do something else.
That's right, Justice McCullough. So it's one punishment here for a totality of violations from two separate cases. So the court has heard a fair amount this morning on the Mr. Jones allegations where she was sent to court by Mr. Morrissey, even though Mr. Jones had hired Mr. Morrissey.
I get the a fortiori argument, but if, you know, in criminal cases we just do pretty much the plain language and maybe, you know, that those canons of construction don't apply to bar disciplinary proceedings or they apply differently. But assisting does seem different than directing. I mean, maybe worse.
But that's not what the disciplinary rule says.
Well, Your Honor, we would submit you can't get around the disciplinary rules by engaging in conduct that's worse than what they were covering here. The idea is you can't sort of take some steps to help somebody or to encourage them to violate the rules. Whereas, in a sense, whether you call it lack of supervisory oversight or you just instructed somebody to basically violate the rules, we would submit that's plainly assisted. Then on the Rule 8.4b charge, if I could turn to that briefly, I understand my friend to mostly be arguing that, well, contributing to the delinquency of a minor just isn't sufficient to constitute a criminal act or any other acts to be deliberately wrongful. I heard my friend say that the Part 13 definition of crime is what applies here, but I have read his brief, and I'm not aware of any citation that says that the Part 13 definition of crime changes what is a criminal act.
Well, that's crime with a C, and what that seems to be directed at is sort of these expedited proceedings. So if you're convicted of that's the way I read it anyway. We're worried as the bar of certain kinds of crimes that should result in an expedited suspension of your license versus, you know, you killed a bunch of people. That's not that. So we may not have to take your license away right away, but it sure is a basis for disciplinary sanction.
That's exactly right, Justice McCullough, and that's our position. It is a criminal act that occurred here, and we submit that there's a variety of criminal act that he actually entered the Alford plea to, and we attached the Lee case to our brief to sort of point out that he's admitted the factual basis for the crime, and it does reflect on his good moral character and ability to be a lawyer in the Commonwealth. In addition, there's plenty of deliberately wrongful acts here, and we need not even get into the debate about whether this is child pornography or not. Simply having somebody send you an intimate photo, regardless of whether you're completely unclothed, and distributing it to your friend without that person's knowledge or consent is a deliberately wrongful act that's inherently untrustworthy. So you have plenty of bases in the record to find an 8.4b violation. And once you establish the violations, then I think you turn to the sanctions issue in this case. And we think
that's probably the easiest part for your case.
I certainly think so, Justice McCullough, because what this court has said repeatedly is in the sanctions context, precedents really don't serve a great deal of help because it's based on the individual person and the individual circumstances of the case. And if you look at the history of this individual, which this court in a prior decision, I think around 2000, said past conduct is relevant, it can come in, it is pretty extreme in terms of being a revocation. I do just want to put before the court to make it clear what the chronology was here. This court extended its grace to give Mr. Morrissey another chance in April of 2012. All of the events that we're standing here talking about with the court this morning occurred basically a year later in 2013. And the events related to Mrs. Battle are eerily similar to what happened in 2002 that led to his license being revoked in the first place. Specifically, he had been hired by a client to advocate on their behalf in a criminal case, and then he ended up having somebody else go to court in his stead. In 2002, it was Mr. Watson, and he had been suspended. Mr. Morrissey had been suspended from the practice of law, and instead of telling Mr. Watson that, he had somebody else go to court in his stead. Here, Mr. Jones had hired Mr. Morrissey to represent him in the criminal case. And rather than telling Mr. Jones that he was double booked and couldn't attend the criminal null pros hearing, he simply sent another lawyer in his stead. So what it shows is just a pattern of misconduct that flagrantly violates the rules of professional conduct. And to come all the way back, Justice McCullough, to your question about a remedy in this case, if the court disagrees with me, either that factual findings aren't required or that they weren't made sufficiently, I think the most that happens is it goes back for the three-judge panel to make factual findings.
As I recall, the rules say bar counsel can even help them with that.
I believe that's correct, Justice McCullough. So that's the most that would happen, but we just submit it's not necessary given the voluminous record and the standard of review that this court applies, which is an independent examination of the entire record. Unless the court has further questions, I'll cede the remainder of my time.
Rebuttal. The bar's theory of how this should work is a due process nightmare. I mean, their brief says basically that everything in the Alford plea is admitted and true. That's not how Alford works. They say the whole record is open and all the facts are in best light to them. It's a blank check. That's not true. There are no findings. The same factual predicate, which they admitted under Kuczynski and Morrissey, means that this has to be sent back. We don't know how many violations went into their analysis, and under Livingston and Barrett, that matters. And in closing, she wasn't told. She didn't say she was told to go. She couldn't remember anything. So please read our footnotes 9 and 5 in our reply brief, because we debunked what they said about that. She couldn't even remember what day this happened or who talked to her. She thought it was Morrissey, but she wasn't sure. Thank you very much.
Call the next case.